Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Wednesday, October 25th, 2017. Your humble host took a day off yesterday to take care of some personal business. And he's back to catch up on a whole array of news. And let me say at the outset, in case you're fresh to the podcast, every day I shoot for about half an hour, around 10 or 12 stories that I think are the most important. And these days, it is really difficult. There is so much news to cover that I have to make difficult choices. And I do hope you indulge me when I go beyond the 30-minute mark. We'll see how I do today. So yesterday, you know that there was a lot of posturing in Washington, D.C. Trump continued his Twitter attacks on Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, who returned fire. And after a unity meeting, a luncheon with all of the Republican senators and Trump to focus on tax cuts for the wealthy, Jeff Flake, the junior senator from Arizona, took to the Senate floor. And he announced that he will not be seeking re-election next year. And he had some very strong comments. We'll cite a few of them in a moment. And he challenged Trumpism, and in particular, he talked about the kind of complicity that Republicans have. But he was focused on the president's weak demeanor and bad behavior. Because a little bit later, Jeff Flake fell into line, along with Bob Corker and John McCain, these mavericks who take on Trump, right? And they all voted, with the vice president providing the tie-breaking vote, to reject a rule that came from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and was 5 years in the making. And it's something I strongly support, and that is we should not be shunted into binding arbitration when we have a dispute with a bank, with a corporation. And whether it's your credit card bill or the statements that you get from your bank, when you sign up for an account, it all includes fine print that says that you waive your right to take them to court, and instead you will submit to binding arbitration, which is a path to getting screwed. Because arbitration always tries to find a middle ground. They will not declare one party right or wrong. They just try to get this thing to be flushed away by coming up with a settlement. And the parties who are guilty don't have to acknowledge that guilt, and the people walk away with a pittance compared to what they might have gotten if they had prevailed in a court of law. And this shows that the Republicans are determined to serve the interests of Wall Street, of the corporations, and of the super wealthy, and prevent pesky consumers from really fighting for their rights. And I consider this to be a very important issue. I've talked about it before. And I want to single out my friend Timur, who's in his 30s. He is a naturalized American citizen, but he was born in Russia. And like many immigrants, he has a fairly literal understanding of the Constitution and the various contracts that our government has with we, the people. And I was talking with Timur recently, and he told me how he's been writing letters to Senator Feinstein and to others, demanding support for the right to sue. And I mentioned Timur because I think it's remarkable that a young person who, you know, could be focused, he's getting married next year, and there are a lot of things that he could easily fill up his time with. And I commend Timur for taking on this rather arcane issue that most people don't care about. And I may have shared with you before that I signed up with a financial advisor, as your humble host is edging into retirement over the next couple of years. And this financial advisor's standard forms require you to waive your right to sue and accept binding arbitration. And I refused to sign. And to its credit, my financial advisor firm quickly removed my objectionable terms there and agreed that if we have a dispute, I can take them to court. So this is a watershed moment, because there are many progressives who look at Corker, who look at McCain, who look at now Jeff Flake, and they tie it to the speech that George W. Bush read last week. And they say, oh, the unity in the Republican Party is crumbling. But it's not true. Now, Flake is very selective in his outrage. And when you look at his history, he has supported Trump policies and nominees about 90% of the time. And the only one who stood up here was Lindsey Graham, who is a troubled soul. But he had previously sponsored legislation to protect members of the military from being forced into arbitration. And he, in fact, did vote against this bill in the United States Senate, along with Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana. But with Mike Pence stepping in, the Republicans had just enough reliable, stalwart idiots to pass this bill. And the recent scandals about Wells Fargo, the massive breach at Equifax, where they have tried to jam arbitration on people who might sue them for the revelation of their private, confidential material, their information. Well, none of that matters to these Republicans, because they would prefer to push through the tax cuts that are so important to them and their benefactors, that they really don't care about the future of what we call this republic. And Jeff Flake is really Exhibit A. And I credit Ross Barkin in today's Guardian for saying that while he said that he can no longer be complicit or silent as Donald Trump rages in the White House, he falls into line when it comes to policies. And Jeff Flake came out of ALEC. When he was operating at the state level, he was a reliable conduit for the Koch brothers and others to ram through their regressive legislation. And in this commentary, Ross Barkin says, Flake epitomizes both the best and very worst of the current political class. He's a savvy opportunist who's been willing to stand up to such destructive, ill-equipped president. Yet Flake is ultimately a phony who should be rejected by anyone with a progressive bone in their body. His qualms with Trump are primarily about decorum. He hates that Trump is not rigorously following the small government right-wing ideology that treats the poor like serfs who deserve to rot and regards the rich as exalted gods in need of further pampering. Flake's chief lament is that Trump is not devoted to limited government, free markets, and free trade. Flake is a tireless defender of the white, the wealthy, and the exploitative. He is a friend of predatory corporations and warmongers. At his core, he is a Republican who sees history somewhat like O'Brien, the ruthless antagonist of George Orwell's 1984, a boot stamping on a human face forever. Flake voted in line with Trump's positions 90% of the time. He supported the Obamacare repeal as recently as July. He cheered Neil Gorsuch's elevation to the U.S. Supreme Court. He confirmed Scott Pruitt to be administrator of the EPA. And the bottom line here is that Jeff Flake took a look at the polls. His reelect numbers were underwater, well below 50, and at 33%, I believe, among Republican voters in Arizona. Now, it is tragic that a figure like Jeff Flake, who's been a very reliable conservative voice, is going to be run out by a very extreme Freedom Caucus, Tea Party, Trump supporter in Arizona. And it says a lot about the voters who remain smitten with Trump, even if they may deplore some of his actions and some of his tweets. They see him as doing what they want to be done. And last night on the Public TV News Hour, Judy Woodruff showed unusual tenacity as she asked first Senator John Thune of South Dakota and then two right-wing Republicans repeatedly if they agreed with Jeff Flake. and they were spinning like a top. Well, you know, Jeff's a really good guy, and I love Jeff, but we have to work with this president, and we got to get us some tax cuts here. And their priorities, which are to put up with Trump, the risk to our security, the risk of new wars, the downright dangerousness and recklessness of this man, they'll put up with it if they can get the tax cuts that they want. And they don't have a way to pay for them. They don't care about that. They know trickle down is a lie. They don't care about that. They want to deliver tax cuts for their wealthy patrons. And that's all that matters. And until we see somebody like John Thune say, you know, I guess getting rid of Trump or reining him in is more important than tax cuts for my rich buddies and for corporate America. Until that happens, please don't, you know, trot out the cruel hoax of impeachment or the invocation of the 25th Amendment as a way to send Trump to the exits. And don't forget that the 50th vote in the Senate last night was Mike Pence, who is actually much more committed to a draconian agenda than Trump likely ever will be. Now, yesterday in the House of Representatives, two committees announced new investigations into Democrats. The House Intelligence Committee, operating under the partly recused chair, Devin Nunes, they have announced that they are going to be looking into the so-called Uranium One deal. And the bumper sticker version is that Hillary Clinton worked to approve a deal that enabled a Russian company, which was not fully Russian-owned or not Russian-controlled at the time, to gain a corner on the international uranium market, including uranium that's mined in the United States. And the allegation is that Bill Clinton, riding atop his foundation and accepting big sums of money for speeches, that he benefited to the tune of $500,000 for a 90-minute speech that he gave after this uranium deal was completed. Now, this is not a new story, and I believe it deserves investigation, but I don't trust the partisan angle that is being pursued here. And the Uranium One story was revived about a week ago by The Hill, the political newspaper in Washington. And many of my progressive friends were posting articles from the Washington Times, the Mooney paper, and saying, hey, look at this. Now, let me be clear. I believe that the investigation into Hillary's email stuff deserves further investigation, and I believe that the Uranium One deal is a stinker. But I believe this is all being raised to undermine the Mueller investigation into the Trump-Russiagate scandal. And so I have mixed feelings, because with Devin Nunes, who is partly recused, as I said, and then the House Oversight Committee under Trey Gowdy. Well, Trey Gowdy ran the Benghazi Inquisition, and it was not fair. It was not factual. And again, while I believe that these matters deserve to be investigated, the people who've announced they're going to pursue them are not credible. They are purely partisan. So, here we go with another sideshow in Washington, D.C. And all of this distracted most Americans from the vote regarding binding arbitration. Because, gosh, there are tweets, there are attacks, there are people talking bad about Trump. Now, as I mentioned, The Hill kind of revived this story. And in the initial outings last week, I felt they didn't add anything new to these issues. But in an article published on October 22nd, under the byline John Solomon and Allison Spann, I think that there are interesting new information, new sources who have surfaced. And it shows that there was apparently, reportedly, a concerted Russian effort to insert spies into the orbit of both Bill and Hillary Clinton after Hillary became Secretary of State in 2009. The FBI monitored a couple of people described as sleepers, one a spy-turned-model named Anna Chapman, and the other a New Jersey accountant named Cynthia Murphy. Chapman was exposed, and I believe she was deported. But the FBI also saw the transaction where Bill Clinton picked up that $500,000 for giving a 90-minute speech to a Kremlin-linked bank, as they call it. And the other murky issue here is that Hillary Clinton didn't individually have the authority to sign off on the Uranium One deal. It was a committee actually led by the Secretary of the Treasury, with the ultimate decision made by the president. But I've always felt that this was a very murky deal. And the quid pro quo with Bill Clinton's good buddy and a Canadian guy who had owned Uranium One, and then he allowed Russians to buy controlling interest, and then there was this deal to sell up to 20% of America's strategic uranium reserves to Uranium One. Well, my inquisitiveness, my curiosity, and my skepticism are both piqued by that. We deserve to know. If you're a regular listener, you know that I've raised many issues about the Clinton Foundation as an intersection of money, politics, and influence. And there are many issues related to the Clinton Foundation and pay-to-play that deserve an honest investigation. But are we going to get it from Trey Gowdy? I really don't think so. We also learned yesterday that the so-called Steele dossier, opposition research that was gathered about Trump and Russian connections, was directly paid for by the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee. It's always been hinted at that someone aligned with Hillary, with the campaign, paid for it. But we now know that Mark E. Elias from the law firm, which is based in Washington, he has acknowledged and he has removed a confidentiality agreement from the firm that he contracted with, which is called Fusion GPS. He's also calling on the Republican people who hired Fusion GPS earlier in the campaign to release Fusion GPS to acknowledge who they are or who they were. Now, I've been driving at this for a long time. I think this is a key component of any investigation into so-called Russian influence. And now that we know that it was directly funded by the Clinton campaign and the DNC, part of a $12 million contract for legal representation with the law firm, well, it is a little bit clearer. And one of the tidbits we've learned is that Steele was not hired by Fusion GPS until the Democrats took over the account, took over payment for it. And I want to note that I've worked on campaigns where I have managed or participated in opposition research. And what you do is you get online, you use Nexus and Lexis, you talk to people, and you gather it all into one big file of raw data. And then you look at, well, what can we prove and what can we go public with that would actually change voters' perceptions of this opponent? We also do pretty rigorous opposition research on our clients to try to figure out what kind of stuff might be dredged up by them in a really dirty campaign, about them in a dirty campaign. So we are learning a lot more about this. And if we can follow the money trail, it appears that the Steele dossier, paid for by the Clinton campaign, was then passed to the FBI. It could have been by Christopher Steele, who had previous relationships with the Bureau. And so it really remains to be seen where this leads. But the exposure of who paid Fusion GPS for the Steele dossier is an important first step. And now looking at the New York Times coverage of this story, the full name of the law firm is Perkins Coie, C-O-I-E. They were paid $12.4 million to represent the campaign and the DNC during the election cycle. And they hired Steele later. You know, this is after the Democrats started paying for the opposition research. And a spokesperson claims that neither the Clinton campaign nor the DNC was directly aware that Fusion GPS had been hired. Apparently, Mark Elias kept that secret. And we turn to Robert Perry at ConsortiumNews.com, the leading journalistic skeptic of the Russiagate story. And he says that this idea that the campaign and the DNC helped pay for the Steele dossier is not surprising, but it is noteworthy given how long the mystery about the funding was allowed to linger. Another mild surprise, says Perry, is the Clinton campaign would have had a direct hand in the financing rather than maintaining arm's-length relationship by having a friend or a friendly super PAC pay for this information. And, as you know, I've been critical of Devin Nunes, the partly recused chair of the House Intelligence Committee, but the rest of the committee wasn't pursuing Fusion GPS, so he's the one who actually pushed for a warrant or something equivalent to compel them to disclose the information. And Bob Perry, who's got a great institutional memory, he notes that back in the 90s when Bill Clinton was the subject of a special counsel who started with Whitewater and ended up with the stain on Monica's dress, that the Clinton team referred to that as cash for trash when the Republican opposition researchers dug up the information about Bill's bimbo problems. And what Perry notes is that Steele's accusations have had a dubious track record for accuracy. Some are able to be corroborated, but some are not. And that's the kind of raw file of oppo research that I find very common in campaigns. It's up to the campaign to take the raw information and decide what to do with it. So I've linked to Bob Perry's column for your perusal. It's in the show file of today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. Every day I like to take a second to thank the people who support my work here at the podcast. People like Tim McKay and Tim McKay and Jim Garrison and Carla Mahoney. They're all dedicated monthly subscribers to this podcast, and I appreciate their support. I invite you to do the same. Just visit peterbcollins.com, click on Menu, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It'll take you to the sign-up page where you've got easy choices to make, options of levels of support that you can kick in for this podcast. You may have heard that Kaspersky Labs, a Russian-based firm that operates in the cyber protection arena, they sell software that's supposed to prevent you from being hacked. And there's been an internal investigation after the U.S. government blasted Kaspersky for a leak of NSA spyware. And Kaspersky says now that they've done their own investigation, and they say that it was the NSA contractor, who we only know as described as a Vietnamese-American, who took home classified information, and he installed it on his personal computer. He later turned off the Kaspersky spyware or malware protection so that he could try to steal a copy of Microsoft Office. And apparently, during the time that the security software was turned off, his computer was hacked, and whoever did it installed a backdoor. Now, I have no way of evaluating the claims of Kaspersky, but independent security analysts say, well, here's Jake Williams, a former NSA employee. Kaspersky's version of events is now at least plausible. He told The Intercept that the level of incompetence at play here is mind-blowing. From an NSA standpoint, I don't see how this can get much worse. In dribs and drabs, we're getting more information about the October 4th ambush of four American soldiers in Niger. And it now appears that they were ambushed, that there were townspeople in cahoots with the rebels who are, we're told, affiliated with the Islamic State. I find that far-fetched. At any rate, the U.S. command did alert JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, which deployed commandos. We don't know if they were SEAL Team 6 or Delta Forces, but they did go there, and they searched for they searched for LaDavid Johnson, the sergeant whose wife went public with the botched and bungled condolence call that was made by Trump. At any rate, Johnson may have become separated from his unit because they were ambushed twice on October 4th, and the JSOC people apparently went looking for Johnson, and they found his remains. And because we know that the widow has been instructed to keep the casket closed, there are suspicions that he was tortured or otherwise disfigured by the people who took him into captivity. The pregnant teenager, undocumented, who's in federal custody in Brownsville, Texas, did successfully terminate her pregnancy this morning. Following a court ruling from the Washington, D.C.-based Court of Appeals, including an affirmative vote by Merrick Garland, the man that Obama had tried to put on the Supreme Court, she was allowed out of federal custody, taken to a doctor where the procedure was performed. And only known as Jane Doe, she said, "My lawyers have told me the people around the country have been calling and writing to show support. I am touched by this show of love from people I may never know and from a country I'm just beginning to know. To all of you, thank you. This is my life, my decision. I want a better future. I want justice." And she remains in custody at what is described as a shelter in Brownsville. Trump's refugee ban, which was delayed in taking effect, expired on Tuesday. And the new executive order says that there will be a special 90-day review of procedures for refugees attempting to enter the United States from 11 countries. Only the White House will not name those 11 countries. I don't know why they're playing games with this. Presumably, it includes the 7 or 8 Muslim majority countries that have been mentioned in the past, like Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, South Sudan, Syria, Yemen. But we don't know. And the executive order will place a hold on the program that allows for family reunification for some refugees who are already here in the U.S. Jennifer Syme at International Rescue Committee says this will add months or potentially years to the most urgent cases, the majority of which are women and children in heinous circumstances. Be sure to see the powerful new documentary, Human Flow, by Ai Weiwei. We've talked about it on this program. I've interviewed Ai, and I hope you get the idea that it's an important documentation of the refugee crisis worldwide today. The U.S. has a serious problem in Iraq because we sided with Baghdad in the crackdown on the Kurds after they voted for independence. But when the Baghdad government sent its troops, which we, of course, bought and paid for and trained, along with Iranian militia fighters, to snuff out this attempt at independence in Kurdistan, it is remarkable how the Kurdish Peshmerga forces just didn't fight. I am shocked by that. Nevertheless, by taking Kirkuk and the oil fields nearby, this is a huge setback for the Kurds. But it creates a new alliance between Baghdad and Tehran, and of course the Trump administration demonizes Iran at every possible turn. And Rex Tillerson, who is on a multi-nation charm tour, Rexon Tillerson, the Secretary of State, as I like to call him, he went to Baghdad and he made a blunt statement saying that the Iran-backed militias involved in the fight against the Kurds should go home. But Iraq's Prime Minister al-Abadi tersely replied that the militias will stay, insisting that they're part of Iraq and symbolize the hope of the country and the region. I don't make a lot of predictions, but this is not going to end well. And Iraq is going to be in a civil war based on religion and national identity for the foreseeable future. The NAACP has issued a warning to African Americans to try to stay off American Airlines after a spate of incidents, including one involving the Reverend William Barber, the leader of the Moral Mondays efforts in North Carolina. The NAACP is warning black travelers about flying American Airlines. A national travel advisory says that you might expect disrespectful, discriminatory, or unsafe conditions. For several months now, the NAACP has been monitoring a pattern of disturbing incidents on American Airlines. We have today taken the action of issuing national advisory alerting travelers to exercise caution in that booking and boarding flights on American could subject them to disrespectful, discriminatory, or unsafe conditions. So William Barber was bumped off a flight after he responded to discriminatory comments from two unruly white passengers. Last week, a 24-year-old African-American Harvard law student and her four-month baby were removed from an American flight after she asked for her stroller back from checked baggage because of a delayed flight. On October 16th, Tamika Mallory, co-chair of the Women's March, accused an American pilot of racial discrimination for kicking her off a flight after he overheard her dispute with a gate agent over her seating assignment. Now, this appears to be so trivial and heavy-handed, but the pattern of aiming these efforts at African Americans is something that I don't think should be ignored. And finally today, we're standing by for the release of the final batch of withheld documents related to the investigation into the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And yesterday, without notice, the FBI released more than 1,500 pages of records related to its investigation of the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting in Connecticut. And for the record, I will say that without having reviewed any of these documents, I've always been uncomfortable with the way that the authorities in Newtown, Connecticut, and at the state level in Connecticut, put really sharp boxes around the investigation. And they claim that they were protecting the grieving parents of the students and teachers who were killed. But it was unprecedented, and I remain uncomfortable. Also, I will just relate that on the day of that shooting, I was listening to live radio coverage, and it clearly stated that they were looking for a second shooter. Now, what I've seen from news accounts indicates that there was no second shooter, that Adam Lanza was a deranged guy who had been acting like a hermit or a shut-in. His mom, who was the first victim of his shooting spree, was telling friends about a month before that he'd become a shut-in. All he did was play video games. So there are some details that are added here, but I don't think we'll ever really know the truth about Sandy Hook. And there are a lot of unhinged people who promote unverified theories that also make me cringe. And it puts me in an awkward spot of not believing the skeptics and also not having confidence in the official narrative. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. It came in at almost half an hour today. I remain your humble host, Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.